the bottom, it looks like a disc cone is being used, a type of disc cone, a lot of elements, or maybe this is just the way he sketched it. It could be a solid, like a funnel upside down. It's either many conductors or a solid conductor. That is not sure of the diagram. Basically, it's the same, though.
Okay, so he does really have ground plane radios. And even if those ground plane radios are inadequate in some way, too long, too short, or whatever, and he's willing to put the right kind of an RF choke, a balloning-like device on the transmission line, he can live with that. As I see it, that shorting rod is a variable short circuit. In other words, he's deciding how many turns on one of those fiberglass rods are shorted out. So the distributed inductance he is changing with that shorting rod. He therefore can force that thing into resonance over quite a number of frequencies, maybe even a 2-to-1 frequency region. And because the directivity of an antenna is primarily a function of the real estate you've established in the dimension that is normal to that. In other words, this thing has 48 inches of length. It primarily is a broadside radio. In other words, at right angles to the 48-inch length is where the majority of the radiation is taking place before we start talking about ground reflection of the earth under the antenna.
Also, Dick, this is vertical.
Agreed. So, if it was in free space, the majority of the radiation is out to the horizon when this thing is vertical. His shorting bar, it has very little horizontal dimension to it from the description I've heard. In other words, the 48 inches of length is a vertical dimension. His shorting bar probably sits left and right. I'm going to pick a number, 3 inches. He has distributed very little real estate horizontally. He's got 90-some-odd% of his real estate vertical. Therefore, the amount of pattern change in azimuth is going to be fairly small. In other words, if you plotted the azimuthal pattern on this antenna, I predict it has a little bit of wow to it. In other words, it's got a direction where the signal is a dB and a half weaker than some other direction because of the way that shorting bar is arranged. I don't think there's going to be a huge front-to-back ratio to really make a significant... Let me drop. To make a significant front-to-back ratio, he'd have to use real horizontal real estate. If he had a similar vertical rod acting as a reflector, roughly a quarter wavelength away in one direction, another vertical rod of just the right electrical length acting as a director, a quarter wavelength or so in another direction, he's now devoting, you know, quarter wave, half wave of real estate in the horizontal dimension. Now he can develop a real azimuthal pattern. But without that, the front-to-back ratio on this antenna, in other words, if he sets it up purely vertical, and he's got that shorting bar going down to the north, and he now figures out how much signal is he squirting north versus south, I think it's only going to be a fraction of a dB of difference. He's going to see a little bit of difference. As you rotate an antenna like this, because of the way you set up your rotator, the way your transmission line lays and loops around the bottom of the antenna, depending on the quality of your ground plane radials and so on, you'll see some slight pattern change. But I don't think it's going to be a huge pattern change, and it's not going to give him a whole lot of directivity, in my belief, from what I've heard so far, John. Without putting out that real estate, you don't get directivity. KC2 WGB, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, basically his question is, because he can short one antenna, well, the turns of those antenna, completely out, by raising that clip all the way to the top of the antenna, he was interested in what effect that was having and what was it doing. But also, he is telling me in this note that he notices 6 dB in direction finding. He notices if he tunes in on a nice signal and he tunes 180 degrees away from that, roughly, well, he said 140 degrees, he gets 6 dB. down. I don't see how that can happen because there's not much separation between the antennas.
Yeah, let's add a few more words here. The shorting clip is a piece of wire which I thought started at the top. I presume it's a flexible piece of wire having a clip on the bottom of it, and you can slide that clip anywhere along the length of one of these spiral wrapped antennas, and maybe both, depending on how he arranges that clip, how big it is. So it's a piece of wire from the top going down some number of turns toward the bottom, so to speak. And the wire itself, the shorting wire, it's not a stretchable thing. It itself has got some looping to it and some dressing to it, which is going to be a factor. But for this thing to have 60 dB of directivity, that is mysterious. You didn't say what is the spacing between the two. A pair of them are 48 inches long, spiral wrapped, lots of turns on each. And from the diagram you've seen, what would you guess, John? 5 inches, 10 inches of separation between the two? As the two elements become separated more and more, you will develop a pattern. And predicting that pattern is not going to be easy. I'm not sure whether or not any of the NEC-like programs can predict that pattern. See if Mike has got a guess on this one. Depending on the spacing between those spiral wrap things and the way the shorting takes place, do you think that any of the modeling programs that we can easily get access to, do you think they could really predict this one? The way those modeling programs break everything up into microscopic elements, finite elements, and now you've got this very complicated three-dimensional structure of a pair of 48-inch long fiberglass rods with lots of turns. My first guess is this is almost beyond many of our modeling programs, but I'm not a big modeling program user. Maybe you are, Mike. WYQU, awful glad you're there. K2LAW in the deck net.
12-inch displacement, by the way.
Okay, let's see what Mike's got to say on this one. Go ahead, Mike.
Sorry, what was the displacement between the two antennas for?
Let's make sure we're waiting for the all four beeps. 12 inches of spacing between these two fiberglass rods, 48 inches long, with a whole lot of turns of what we think is 16-gauge bare wire on each one. I think this is almost beyond what modeling programs can easily handle. WY2U, wait for the beeps. K2LAW.
Well, the modeling programs, if these were actually straight pieces of wire, if you choose enough current pulses on the wires, chances are you can get a reasonably accurate prediction on pattern. Not necessarily so for impedance, but on pattern. But it gets complicated by the fact that he's got a very large distributed inductance making the elements, that make up the elements, I should say. So that probably is well beyond the capability of a personal computer. So I agree there. I'm a little bit skeptical about his measurement that says he has 60 dB of directivity in this antenna when you're driving current into both elements. In order to get about a 60 dB dispersion on pattern, you'd probably have to have almost, if not equal, close to equal currents in the two antennas and opposite. And that's not possible, I think, in this topology. At least I'm not seeing it. And by the way, I have a little different picture than what you got, Dick. I got the impression that the shorting bar started at the bottom. I guess that would make little difference, but from what John was saying, I thought the shorting bar starts where the feed point is, and then you can short it from the bottom going to the top. I don't think this is anything really special. It looks just to me like it's a linearly loaded antenna, except instead of making the two elements out of wire, he elected to make the two elements out of a piece of distributed inductance, which is going to make the equivalent antenna longer. And then he has the ability to short one side out or the other attempt to get a different point of resonance, I guess. So this to me is just a simple linear-loaded antenna, a linearly loaded ground plane that's distributed loaded with inductance operating over a counterpoise. So I don't know if this thing operates on more than one band or whether it's just a single 10-meter band, I can't say. But the fact that he's claiming a 60 dB directivity, I'm quite skeptical of that. K2RIW and the group WY2U.
He's got one thing in his favor, and that is one of the spiral-wrapped antennas is essentially virgin. The other one he's shorting out. Therefore, although the whole structure is resonant, he could have a significant amount of phase difference on the current distribution between these two vertical distributed inductor rods that are separated by 12 inches. So he has the ability to have different phase angle of the conduction of the two rods with 12 inches of separation. He's got a few of the ingredients, a little bit of the ingredients in the direction of directivity. If I've got two elements side by side, and if I fed them 180 degrees out of phase, I could get a significant amount of directivity, even though they're only 12 inches apart. He's moving in that direction. I can see how he can get some directivity. Like you, I'm having trouble believing it's as much as 6 dB, but it's not completely impossible. And because of the degree of difficulty of modeling of this antenna, I think he's better off doing an empirical experiment. Let me drop.
I have a question, Dick.
This is one of those situations where when you're doing physical measurements of an antenna, assuming you've got some kind of a mediocre antenna range, and you're doing a bunch of fiddling with inductors, capacitors, shorting bars, and whatever, you could do 10 experiments in 1 hour. And if you were using a modeling program that was stealthy enough that it could handle something this complicated, it might take you 4 hours of calculating on each change. So you can get a hell of a lot more answers doing it in the real world. And that's the right way to do it in this case. So I see some of the ingredients of possibility here, John. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, just for my own edification, maybe Mike or you could answer this question, because he doesn't indicate, are they wound in the same continuous way, or are they counterwound? Would that make a difference? What do you think? KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
With 12 inches of spacing, I think that makes no difference at all, John. The fact that it's wound at all makes it a distributed inductor. The fact that the diameter of those rods is probably only an inch or two means that each individual turn has very little horizontal real estate. The 200 turns or whatever it is along the length gives them a hell of a lot of vertical real estate. The horizontal real estate is so little that whether I wind an inductor clockwise or counterclockwise, I get very close to the same inductance. If they were extremely close to each other by comparison to their diameter, yes, you're going to get some transformer coupling. With 12 inches of spacing, very little transformer coupling between the two. So clockwise and counterclockwise, I think, is a second-order effect, John. That's my first guess. But then again, that's one of the things to experiment with. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I hope I hear from this gentleman after he finishes this thing and has some real testing done on it. He's only had it operating for a week, and he's, again, now his S-meter, you know, that kind of directivity is a little tough to tell with an S-meter, but that's what he's claiming. All right, well, we'll see how it goes. That's about it from the mailbag. This is KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
A quick question for you, Dick, real quick.
Go right ahead, John. Wait for the beep. Correction, you know who you are. Sorry about that, Mike.
Yeah, okay, I'm having a little problem trying to visualize, no matter how I connect the jumper or short these distributed turns, how you get anywhere near 180 degrees. But I tell you what, I can probably convince myself that you might get 90. Two equal currents at 90 degrees would give you 3 dB directivity. So like you said, some of the ingredients are there, but not 6 dB. I could see 3. Go ahead.
I'm with you, Mike. And one other thing you got to worry about. I have in the past taken a signal generator, plugged it into my various ham radio receivers, 6 meters, 2 meters, HF rigs, and whatever. What I find in general is that if your S-meter on your rig was really well calibrated, there's supposed to be 6.02 dB of difference between each S-unit. When you go from S2 to S3, there's supposed to be a 6.02 dB of change, 2 to 1 voltage ratio. S9 is supposed to be 50 microvolts, and S8 is supposed to be 25. 5 microvolts and so on. Well, very few S-meters are like that. Most S-meters are, in my opinion, very liberal. In other words, they have around 2 or 3 dB of difference between the S-units instead of 6. So therefore, unless you have done a real laboratory signal generator calibration of your S-meter, using the S-meter on a ham rig to try to make antenna measurements can give you some pretty crazy results, and I've seen some of those. So that could be one of the variables involved. On top of that, this is a 10-meter antenna, I understand, and on 10 meters, unless you're pretty smart and know the way to set up a reflective ground plane antenna range, any reasonable-looking antenna range without that smarts, without following the Dick Turin technique, W2IMU, which you can see in the ARRL antenna book under the section of transmission lines and measurements. Let me drop. Unless you read the W2IMU section on setting up a reflective ground plane antenna range, there's a zillion ways that you and I can set up a more conventional antenna range on 10 meters in the backyard. The ground reflection, the reflection off the downspouts of the house or whatever, can give you all kinds of crazy effects. So when you're setting up an antenna range, you think you're measuring an antenna. You're really measuring the combination of the antenna and all the environment around it. Life gets complicated. So these are some of the complications that make life a little more difficult in quantifying things like this. WYTU, K2LAW, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, you're bringing up some interesting points. We don't really know how well calibrated his receiver measurements are, or just, I gather he was trying to do some direction finding. His application was direction finding, where he could be certainly at the mercy of ground reflections as he turns the antenna and that type of thing. So, well, I'm afraid, John, the jury's still out on this one. I can probably justify, just based on a very, very quick phaser diagram, 3 dB of directivity. Kind of hard to measure even that, but I can probably see that. I can't see 6 because that would require, again, current differences in both conductors close to 180 degrees, and I just don't see it, unless I'm missing something in the topology, I don't see it being possible and just shorting out a couple of turns of distributed inductance. I don't see how you can get that much phase shift. Maybe if the gentleman's listening, he might be able to give us some more information for next time, but right now the jury's still out, I'm afraid, there. Dick, K2RIW in the group, WI2U.
Thank you for your input, Mike, and we're glad you're here tonight. Now, even with 3 dB of, let's call it, front-to-back ratio, could he use his antenna for fox hunting if he's smart enough with enough experience? With difficulty, maybe. It sure would be nice to have, let me pick a number, a 10 dB front-to-back ratio on a direction-finding antenna. So you get a clearly defined null in some direction, and if you know the characteristics of your antenna, you can say, I think that fox is in that direction. With only 3 and the usual multipath you get in a real environment on a moving vehicle, boy, unless he's very smart, that's going to be tough. So I guess we're going to send him back to the drawing board, John, to confirm that what his 6 dB was really on a well-calibrated S-meter, as opposed to a raw S-meter on the conventional receivers we all buy. What kind of antenna range was he using when he made the measurements? And is this the way to go? If I was trying to build a fox-hunting antenna, there's various ways you could do it with a loop, proper ways of setting up a loop. You can get a pretty good front-to-back ratio, a vertically polarized loop, or if I'm willing to use parasitic elements, reflectors and directors, I can get a lot of directivity. But this particular method of approach as a direction-finding antenna, Mike and I both feel it's a pretty tough way to go. He might not get there unless he's done something that we haven't yet known about. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Good question. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. I wish to thank Mike for his input, too. Important. Now, another thing, Dick, and Mike also, we're used to using some pretty sophisticated equipment, and I don't want to spook or scare anybody. Remember, all you guys out there, you can do some great experimenting. You know, I happen to have a lab. I'm lucky. But you can do it with very simple equipment, that's nice to have, but you can have a lot of fun without it. Just wanted to put that in there, Dick. So, yeah, and I concur that I don't think 6 dB sounds right, and it doesn't work out in the math either. So he's going to have fun, but it would be nice if he could find a way to get a more accurate determination. That I believe. Okay, Dick, back to you. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I hope Mike is going to be here for a few more minutes, because there's another subject I want to hit you with, Mike. And this is a hypothesis of mine. Because of Hurricane Sandy, roughly 100 Americans died along the East Coast, many of them in the New York City area. Many of them appear to be drownings. It's my hypothesis that a significant number of those drownings are electrocution. If your body is in salt water is pouring into your basement, and you say, gee, Aunt Susie's beautiful, valuable pictures are down there, and that vase is down there, and you go down into that salt water in that basement to recover what you think is a valuable item. And if any of that salt water touches any electrical circuit, just one circuit that's on the washing machine or comes up to the level of the fuse panel, whatever, if that salt water touches a live electrical circuit and your body is in that salt water, in my opinion, you're in a heap of trouble, because salt water, sea water, has a well-documented resistivity of 0.2 ohm meter. If I had a plastic fish tank, let me drop. I had a plastic fish tank that is a 1 meter cube. And the left-hand side, I've got a 1 square meter sheet of metal. And the right-hand side, I've got a 1 square sheet of metal. And I fill up this plastic fish tank, 1 cubic meter, with 1 cubic meter of sea water. And I put an ohm meter between those two sheets. I will measure 0.2 ohm on an AC ohm meter. That's to make sure you're not developing galvanic action. When your body is in seawater, up to your waist, approximately 1 meter, square meter of your skin is in contact with that seawater. Therefore, the resistance between your body and that seawater could be as low as half an ohm. That wrist strap that you and I wear when we're protecting ourselves from ESD circuits that we're assembling on a bench has a 1 megaohm resistor in series with it to protect you from electrocution. You lower that resistance to half an ohm, which is my guess, and you're in a heap of trouble. So I think a number of those drownings are electrocutions. What happens when you're in that seawater and the current is flowing through it and you're being electrocuted, or at least your muscles are not operating correctly, you can't extricate yourself from that seawater. You eventually end up breathing the seawater, and yes, if they do an autopsy, they're going to find seawater in your lungs, and they think you simply drowned. I think a lot of those were electrocutions. I've started an experiment where I want to put my left arm in a vat of seawater and my right arm in a vat of seawater and measure the number of ohms between the two vats. I've done that experiment. I won't tell you the results yet, but let me feed that over to you, Mike, and I wonder if you've thought about that, if you think that hypothesis is possible. WY2U, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
WY2U. Yeah, gosh, that certainly is possible. You say you did the experiment. Well, I'll tell you right now, 10 milliamperes of current, if it goes through your heart muscle, even in healthy people, could be enough to cause the heart to stop, go into fibrillation. 240-volt electrical service. I can't do these in my head, and I just turned my computer off. How much resistance would you need to develop before you get 10 mils? Well, 1 amp would be 240 ohms. A tenth of an amp is 2.4K. 24K of resistance across your arms would be enough on a 240-volt electrical system to, even in a healthy person there, Dick, provide depth by fibrillation. So what is your number? If it's less than 24K, I agree with you. Go ahead.
The seawater itself has a resistivity of 0.2 ohm meter. So in that fish tank experiment, you would measure 0.2 body has roughly a meter of flesh exposed to that seawater. And my hypothesis is this. When you and I grab 2 ohm-meter probes, a very little bit of area is touching the index finger and thumb on your right hand, and the same thing in your left hand. Excuse me. And you can easily come up with 100K or 200K when you do that experiment. However, as I start increasing the amount of area that's in contact with my left hand and my right hand, so to speak, and I've now got a whole lot of parallel paths through that skin, into the flesh, into the bloodstream. I've now got a zillion parallel paths as I start putting my whole left hand and arm into that seawater versus my right hand and an arm. And once you get significant conductivity between the skin, all those parallel paths, into the bloodstream is a highly saline solution, extremely conductive. Look at that as wires. You've now got a bunch of wires called blood, your vascular system between left hand and right hand going directly through the chest, through the heart. Under those conditions, the Wikipedia experiment, the Wikipedia states that 60 milliamps of 60 cycle current can be lethal. It can put a significant number of people into fibrillation. DC current requires something closer to 200 milliamps, but 60 milliamps, left hand to right hand, of AC current can do it. And I see the possibility of a very small number of ohms. Let me drop. I tried doing the experiment. I poured a whole bunch of table salt into the water in my left hand metal pan and my right hand metal pan, put the ohm meter between the two, and put my hand and arm in the left hand pan, my hand and arm in the right hand pan. And I expected to measure, let me pick a number, 10 ohms, something like that. I measured 800,000. I said, bull. I reversed the two probes going to the two metal pans, and I measured negative 200 ohms. I said, bull. What was happening is that I really was developing a battery. It turns out the left-hand pan was stainless steel, the right-hand pan was aluminum, and I got salt water between the two. I'm making a battery. I've got to go back and repeat that experiment. I've got to make sure the two pans are identical. And whenever you're measuring conductive fluids and you're trying to measure ohms, it really has to be an AC ohmmeter. Because even if I had identical pans and identical salinity of the two solutions, you're still doing a galvanic action. You're starting to charge a battery with DC current, if you know what I mean. It's very similar to trying to measure the number of ohms between two ground rods in your backyard. It's got to be an AC ohmmeter. Otherwise, you get one answer in the first millisecond, you get another answer 10 seconds downrange as you start doing a charging of those rods through that slightly conductive soil, if you know what I mean. So I've got to repeat the experiment, but I know we're going to be way below 24K if you think that's the threshold of alarm, and it could very well be. There's a huge number of variables in here. How high a voltage? Where's the ground? What's the... What's the E field in volts per meter? How widely are separated your arms or your legs? You could have the situation where you've got a very well insulated basement, very good cinder block walls where ordinarily water wouldn't come in except that it's pouring in through the window, so to speak, your salt water. And the fuse panel is in contact with the water at one end and a grounded water pipe is at the other end. You could be 20 feet away from the fuse panel, near the grounded water pipe, the whole damn body of water could all be up at 120 volts AC, and there's a great big E field around that grounded water pipe, and you're standing near that grounded water pipe, and the volts per meter across that water could be enough to kill you. So you could be far away from the fuse panel, near a grounded object, and still get into a lot of trouble. There's a lot of variables involved when it comes to a volumetric conducting fluid, and you put a human being into it, and a lot of area of that human being. The bottom line of all this, in my opinion, is that if salt water is in your environment, and if there is any electrical circuit active at that time, make sure your body is not in that salt water within some ridiculous number of feet of that source of electrical energy, is my feeling on that one. Now, my WYQU, you probably got some comments on this one. K2LIW in the deck net.
KCT.
2, QIQ with a comment.
Ah, I think that's Glenn. Hey, how you doing, Glenn? Haven't spoken to you in a while.
Yeah, I agree. The only thing I'm having a little bit of a problem with is the 60 milliamps, I think, there. I thought it was quite a bit less than that, something like 10 milliamps, although I could be misreading it, and that could be the amount of threshold current in an infirm person or an infant, and maybe a healthy person, the current could be quite a bit higher. You're bringing up some interesting points, because that is a complicated problem. We don't know what the, I guess you said electric field, the potential difference between the source and the ground of the liquid environment is. And now you're putting a conductor of sorts, a lossy conductor in that liquid environment. And if that lossy conductor is the right impedance, a certain significant amount of current will be diverted into you. And again, if it's more than 10 milliamps, and if it goes to the path to the heart, I think you could be in serious trouble. I'm curious, though, Dick, why would you want to use a AC impedance meter rather than just not, because you want to pass current through your body. I was trying to figure out a way out of that by simply using a relatively low voltage, 60 hertz signal generator and a grain of wheat bulb or something, and just measure the, if you can, the equivalent impedance or the drop across the bulb or something by just doing an AC voltage drop measurement. Wouldn't that be easier to do rather than try to seek out an AC impedance meter? Over to you first, Dick, then to Glenn. Go ahead.
The way an ordinary DC ohm meter works, Mike, it really is an impedance meter. In other words, depending on which scale you're on, you're just determining how much series resistance is between the battery and the unknown circuit, and you're measuring the voltage drop across that resistance and interpreting it into ohms. And whether or not that source of energy is a DC battery or an AC battery, an AC signal generator, and whether or not your detector is a DC voltmeter or an AC voltmeter, to make an AC ohm meter is not too difficult. But because conductive fluids like soil or salt water, you put the two copper probes in salt water and start putting a current through them, a DC current, by way of your ohm meter, you're starting to do an electroplating process. As such, one rod is copper, the other rod is copper with some other ion plated onto it, and what you think is the number of ohms will continuously change. Only an AC ohm meter in that case can give you an accurate answer. And so, by the way, what I did in that case of my two baths of salt water, and I touched them with my hands, my fingers, or whatever, I decided to stop measuring ohms, and I put the meter into the voltmeter scale, and I measured 600 millivolts. You put 600 millivolts because of the battery action here of slightly different saline solutions. I tried mixing those together and make them the same, but one was a copper container. One was an aluminum container, the other was a stainless steel container. I really was making a battery, a 600 millivolt battery, and you put 600 millivolts into an ohm meter. You'll get some crazy positive and negative readings that have very little to do with reality. And by the way, whether or not the lethal current, whether or not the lethal current is 10 milliamps, 40 milliamps, or 60 milliamps, really is academic. It's in that ballpark of current, which could get you in trouble. The threshold of sensing electrical current is in the vicinity of 1 milliamp. The average person at 1 milliamp says, yeah, I start feeling it. By the time it gets up to 20, 40, or 60 milliamps, you're way beyond feeling it, and you could be getting in trouble. Left hand to right hand, and that conductive fluid throughout your vascular system through the heart is a beautiful chunk of wiring that can do terrible things to the heart. Even left leg to right leg with those vascular system that goes up one set of veins through the heart, back down to another set of, arteries, you know what I mean. There's all kinds of electrical wiring through that blood system of human being that can get that heart into a lot of trouble. So you don't want to play around with any of this. Glenn, I know that you're approximately a mile from the water, or almost, as I drove up Division Avenue. Your house, I believe, I've seen your house on Google on the east-hand side, and to get all of the water that you got in your house, wow. And I think... The good news is that if you were home at the time, I think they cut off the electrical power because where that water entered your home, that seawater, and if you were in that seawater, I think there's a lot of risk involved. KC2QIQ, K2LIW on the tech dot.
Yeah, good evening, Vic. Good evening, Mike, and everybody on the net tonight. It's good to be back. Actually, I'm just recovering here, getting everything back on the air again. And I wanted to join the TechNet tonight, and just hearing what you were mentioning, Vic, that certainly, you know, any kind of water and electricity is always a bad mix. You know, just I think here again, another concern of mine was during the storm is that the ocean temperatures of the water was around 40 degrees, and certainly anybody who is in the water, at least, you know, waist or higher deep, in 40-degree water, it really causes problems because you don't have a lot of time. This hypothermia starts settling in pretty quick, too. So for people who actually got trapped in water for any period of time, for more than a few minutes, would have been in trouble to begin with. And certainly, of course, the hazard of electrical power and being in water is never a good one either. So I have to agree with you there. The only thing is, I think on the analysis side, the way I would approach this would be more in areas of volts per meter. I think one of the problems, let me look at the straw for a second. When I think of water as a conductive body, one of the interesting things is there must be a sweet spot in terms of you know, voltage distribution across the fluid as well as the current capability of the fluid. Because one of the things, which would also depend on your proximity to the conductor and the power source, because if you're in the middle of the water and the impedance of the water is relatively low, you could actually have relatively low volts per meter, let's say, across the fluid. So it may not be enough voltage to electrocute you. But certainly, if you're close enough to a panel and you're in the water and the water is relatively at one side close to neutral and you're getting close to a panel, or someplace where the line connection would be, yeah, certainly you would be in that path, and that would be a very, very dangerous situation, Dick. I'm going to pass it back to you. K2RIW, K22QIQ. Good to hear you guys again. Until you see
you. You're absolutely right, Glenn. When it comes to analysis of this problem, the beginning of it is to be able to plot three-dimensionally the volts per meter E-field, which is really a bunch of constant voltage surfaces throughout that volumetric fluid. When I finally do get this experiment of resistivity between my left hand and my right hand in two vats of salt water, I am guessing I'm going to come up with a number in the vicinity of 10 ohms to 50 ohms from my left hand to my right hand, when my left hand and forearm and my right hand and forearm are in two separate vats of seawater with a AC ohmmeter between the two. This is what I think the answer is going to be when I get rid of the problem of the electrovoltaics that I've been generating by dissimilar metals and dissimilar fluids and so on. It's a complicated project. But if I do come up with a number, let me pick a number out of the air. Let's assume that my left hand to my right hand, when a lot of it is in seawater, happens to be 10 ohms. And now you calculate how many volts from left hand to right hand in the E field of the seawater would give you, let me pick your number, 20 milliamps of current flow. It's going to be an extremely small number of volts per meter on that seawater in that environment. And the next thing you'd have to worry about is my left hand and my right hand. Is one of them closer to the source and the other one further from the source? If you plot the constant voltage contours throughout that seawater, if I can keep my body at right angle, parallel to those constant voltage sources, while I walk back out of that, would I survive, and so on. When I was having this discussion with a bunch of firemen that I was with today, let me drop. There was some Melville fireman who described a situation where a high voltage line, 13.8 kilovolts, was on the ground in a puddle of water. And these firemen were now discussing whether or not they can put their boots in that water in order to control a fire that's nearby. And boy, is there a lot of variables involved in that case. Now you're talking about a huge amount of voltage, 13.8, with some number of feet of water. And yeah, maybe that's not seawater. Maybe that's fresher water, but it's got a whole lot of other contaminants in it. And you worry about, is there a crack in the rubber boots that they're wearing, or are they wearing leather boots, and so on. And so there's a significant difference among firemen as to whether or not they can touch that puddle of water when 13 kilovolts is down. lancing in it, and it's a live wire doing a whole lot of arcing and sparking. And could they spray water in that situation without the conductivity of the spray of water getting back to the guy with the nozzle in his hand? There's a lot of variables involved here. And so in some cases, fire trucks will have this diamond metal pattern, a diamond metal panel that can be pulled out from the bottom of the control panel on the side of the truck where you've got all of your knobs and connectors and so on, so that a fireman can stand on that as opposed to standing on ground with his hands touching the fire truck while they're doing an operation with live wiring. In theory, the fireman would like to be standing on this panel above ground, part of the truck, during that particular kind of operation. There's been a number of examples of where a cherry picker or something like that touched a high tension line, a man standing on the ground touched the cherry picker and died. There's been a number of examples of that. So water, high voltage, electrocution, we got to worry about all these things.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Wes, if you've got a question on this subject, please try to make it a little bit brief. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I try, but I don't have the skills. Looks like everybody's playing the same melody in here. I hear four gentlemen, and all of them, they say the same. Let me try with quite the opposite scenario. Theoretically, you have a metal container, a box, and you have a man inside, and you immerse it into the water. The body resistance is about 1 kilo ohm. The metal resistance is milliohms, and the salt water is 0.5 ohm. Another scenario. Have you ever heard, Dick, about dead people in the cruise, or in the ship, or in the fish ship, made out of the metal, when the lightning strike the water in the ocean, and you didn't, that's why. Let me jump. I've been many times in a situation where there is a extremely salt water, much more salt water than in Atlantic Ocean, in Baltic Ocean. I swim, and the lightning popped out. Nothing happened. Now, imagine yourself that you are 1 kilo ohm, and the water is the 0.5 ohm. Of course, you're talking about the electrolytic reaction, but let's leave it for a moment. Now, put those two resistors together in parallel, and count how much current is going to go through the 1 kilo ohm resistor. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying that I'm right. I'm saying you're great playing one melody. And to XGM.
If the voltage, one terminal of the voltage was touching me, and the other terminal is touching the seawater, and if there's a small number of ohms between me and that seawater, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble. If lightning strikes the seawater, and the lightning strikes the seawater a long distance away, so that the E field through the seawater in the vicinity where I am is 0.1 volt per meter, I'm probably not in trouble. If the lightning strikes close enough to me, where the volts per meter on that seawater is, let me pick a number, 50 volts per meter, I'm in a lot of trouble. There have been people in seawater who did become electrocuted when lightning struck the seawater nearby. There are people who have, there are cows in the field who have died from electrocution when a lightning bolt struck a metal fence nearby or struck the ground nearby, depending on which way the cows were aiming toward the lightning bolt or parallel to it, some of them died, some of them survived. So there's a lot of variables involved here, and there's more to it. We'll soon find out when I complete this experiment with my once I repeat the experiment with my number of ohms from left hand to right hand, when a lot of area of those hands are in contact with the seawater. One of the biggest variables. A person just grabbing the two probes on a an ohmmeter comes up with a very high number. By the way, one of the things I did was to leave the two ohmmeters connected to the metal pan, the stainless steel pan, and the aluminum pan, and I just simply put my hand on the aluminum pan and my hand on the stainless steel pan. I forget what the number of ohms I came up with. I think it was in the vicinity of 150 ohms. If there's enough area of your hand in contact with two metal surfaces, the total number of ohms from left hand to right hand can be a very small number. You get a very different answer than simply grabbing the probes. So the amount of area of skin in contact with the conducting thing, whether it be metal or seawater, is a huge variable involved. And now the E field across that seawater in volts per meter is a function of where is the source of voltage, where is the grounding of the voltage, how far you are from it, and how is your body oriented. A lot of variables involved. It's more than just simply a parallel resistor of 1,000 ohms of human being and half an ohm of water. There's much more involved in that. I think we should leave this particular subject now because I've got a lot more measurements to make. By the way, while we're on subjects of crazy things, let me show you something else.
You get the space report, Dick.
Okay. I'm going to delay the space report a little bit. Hope Paul can tolerate this one. When you look up with a web search, who invented the microwave oven? You come up with the name Percy Spence. Percy Spence worked for the Raytheon Company. He was working on magnetron tubes. He had a chocolate bar in his pocket. As he was near the microwave tube that was running, the chocolate bar melted. And he said, aha, that's the beginning of something that became a microwave oven. Beautiful sounding story. We all accept it. I do not accept it. What I did recently was to take a glass of water, 8-ounce glass of water, put it in my microwave oven, alongside of a bunch of chocolate chips that were sitting on top of a block of foam with some wax paper underneath, just in case they melted so they wouldn't melt into the foam. Ran the microwave oven, 750 watts, for a solid minute. The water began to boil in the glass. The chocolate chips did nothing. The next thing I did was say, okay, chocolate is not a bipolar molecule, not a polar molecule like water. The water heats up because of the polar molecule. And individual water molecules are trying to flip back and forth and follow the microwave energy at 2.4 gigahertz. The chocolate is not a polar molecule. There's very little water in the chocolate. I said, okay, maybe it is the almonds or other nuts. So I went and picked up some chocolate-covered almonds, repeated the experiment. They ran ice cold. I then picked up a bunny rabbit, one of these chocolate bunny rabbits, and put it in the microwave oven and ran it for a solid minute. The middle of the stomach of the bunny rabbit got a little bit soft. The rest of the bunny rabbit ran ice cold. So in other words, chocolate does not...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
KQN with comments.
IQN recognized. We'll get to him here in a minute there, Chris. The, what I was going to start to say, the microwave oven, I'm putting a huge E-field across that chocolate inside that microwave oven. Could that E-field have been anywhere near that strong with a human being nearby into the chest of Percy Spence, away in hell? I think what really happened is Percy Spence was operating with a chocolate bar in his pocket in the summertime, and the heat of his body melted the chocolate bar, and he thought it was the microwave oven, and it's a good sounding story, but I think there's a lot of non-truth to it. Chris, go ahead with your comment on this one. KB2IQN, K2LIW.
Okay, I actually read the article you're describing about with Percy Spencer from Raytheon, and the way the microwave tube, the traveling wave tube was invented was for radars in World War II, and they were operating lots of these in the room, and they found that the lights in the room were getting illuminated even when they were off, and that's actually the first indication that they had that there was something else you know, going on with the microwaves in the room. And the first microwave oven operated at 800 megahertz, not 2.4 gigahertz. That's the other thing. Anyway, back to net.
Hey, Casey, too, can you like the comments on this?
Yeah, thank you, Chris, and Glenn recognized. The exact frequency you run a microwave oven at almost doesn't matter. Some of the early ones were 800 megs. Some of the early diathermy machines were 27 megs. The modern-day microwave oven is 2.4 gigs, 2.45 gigs, simply because that frequency is left over, it's available. It's a high enough frequency we can make a convenient-sized cavity for the microwave oven itself. So the heating process is not frequency-sensitive per se. As long as you know how many watts you're putting into that water, the first resonance of water is around 24 gigahertz, and very few of us are going to run a microwave oven at 24 gigs. So, yes, when you put a strong enough E-field, and many of us have held a fluorescent tube near the final stage of our transmitter, near the plate, and we've seen the lighting of the tube, there is a kind of a plasma, the mercury vapor inside the tube. You put a strong enough E-field nearby, you extend the microwave, you excite the plasma inside, and the phosphor lights up. So lighting phosphor from a strong magnetic field, absolutely, I'll give you that. But chocolate being a non-polar, it's not a polar molecule like water. The majority of what your microwave oven does is heats water. You put thoroughly dry bread in a microwave oven alongside of a glass of water, and the glass of water has got to be there, otherwise the microwave oven thinks it's empty. The bread will stay ice cold if it's thoroughly dry bread. It's the water in your food that does most of the cooking. And when that water is frozen in the form of ice, it almost stops doing that. You put an ice cube in a microwave oven, as I have done, or a snowball, and it gives you very little heating. You get no heating at all of the snowball or the ice, only the water. When water goes from the liquid form to the crystalline form that you and I call ice, let me drop. Those individual polar molecules are now locked into a matrix. They're no longer free to rotate, and the heating effect almost disappears. Ice will not behave the way you think it should in a microwave oven. That's the reason why you have a so-called defrost cycle. And so, Glenn, go ahead with that one. So here we are, let me think, 50 years downrange. We all believe that the Percy Spencer story is accurate. I'm challenging it. It's just another one of these cases where it's a logical sounding thing. I mean, everybody believes that a UHF connector has got half a dB of loss at 452 megacycles. Absolutely not. But everybody's been telling each other that for years. Nobody challenged it. I actually went and made the measurements one day. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead with your comment.
Very well stated, Dick. I think most people realize that if you put a chocolate bar inside the microwave oven, it's not going to melt. But, you know something, there may be something more to this story. You know, I'm thinking this myself, just being an engineer myself and, you know, working in labs and working with things. And I'm one of those engineers who occasionally have been known to put the candy bar in my pocket, and it sits there for quite a while until I actually have time enough to get away from what I'm working on to actually have the bar. And amazingly enough, it doesn't really melt in your pocket. But here's a possibility. He might have been working very, very close to the microwave tube, and he may have actually started absorbing some of that, some of the microwave energy himself, and started to perspire, which may have started melting it. So maybe that's a little bit more in tune with what was really going on there, is that he may have been absorbing and perspiring and noticed, wow, what happened here? He normally keeps that candy bar in his pocket all the time, and nothing ever happened. And this particular time, he's like, ooh, it's coming from the tube. Back to you, the K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Another logical sounding thing, Glenn. One of the things that happened when I last entered the hospital is they measured my skin temperature by taking a thermometer-like thing and waving it across my forehead. And I think they came up with something like 97 degrees, and they were happy, or 96 degrees, and they were happy. I wasn't running a temperature from their point of view. They didn't bother sticking it under my tongue. If I held a temperature-measuring device against your chest, Glenn, I think I would measure something in the vicinity of 96 degrees. If I now heat your chest to the point where you start sweating, I think I'd have great difficulty getting your chest above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Your body wouldn't tolerate much more than that. So a non-heated human being and a heated human being, the way the body operates with its thermal regulating system and the prodigious amount of blood that flows through the arteries and veins of your chest, it's very difficult to make a large number of degrees of difference in temperature of that chest. So I'm having trouble with that explanation. And the fact that you're sweating versus non-sweating, I think it's going to make very little difference on the chocolate bar. Depending on what brand of chocolate and how well it's wrapped and so on, there's a lot of variables involved. But for him to think he was melting the chocolate bar by way of RF energy, and yet the RF energy was not giving him a eye danger to the cornea of his eye, and he would feel it. I have put my hand in front of a X-band WR90 waveguide when 200 watts is coming out of that traveling wave tube. Boy, you feel that heat in a hurry, and you wouldn't stay there very long. So the amount of heating that would be required to even begin to melt the chocolate directly, his body would not tolerate that. He would flee from that immediately. So there's a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
There's a bunch of parts of this story are making me very skeptical. A number of people have tried to measure how good is the Tupperware. Is it rated for microwave? And they just simply put the Tupperware in the microwave oven. Wrong. You don't want to do that. Because as the Tupperware gets better and better in its dielectric quality, its dielectric loss tangent, the microwave oven eventually thinks it's thoroughly empty. And what happens in that case is that the little probe from the tube is dumping 750 watts into the microwave oven. It bounces back and forth, and there's nothing in that microwave oven that'll absorb it except the probe itself. Therefore, the probe, which is a transmitting antenna, becomes a receiving antenna, and 750 watts comes back into the tube. So no matter what the tube had to dissipate before, with a microwave oven empty, the tube now has to dissipate an extra 750 watts, and in many cases, that will wipe out the tube. So you never want to operate a microwave oven with no load. As such, whenever you're testing any material, there should be, in my opinion, something like an 8-ounce glass of water, at least a cup of water, but preferably an 8-ounce glass of water in the microwave oven as the standard load, and that's some significant distance away from the glass of water. Let me drop. You put the substance that you're testing. If you're really doing a thorough job, you'll measure the temperature of the substance before and after the microwave exposure. And in the case of chocolate, I don't see any significant amount of heating of chocolate with or without nuts, raisins. Oh, by the way, when I did the experiment with raisins, I did get a little bit of melting, but the raisins contained water vapor, a slight amount of moisture to the raisins. So chocolate-covered raisins, I did see some melting. Chocolate-covered peanuts and chocolate-covered almonds, no melting. A chocolate bunny rabbit, essentially no melting. So the Percy Spencer story is giving me a lot of trouble, as you can tell. I'm glad he got... By the way, he did the right thing for the wrong reason, in my opinion. He believed the microwave oven is a convenient way of heating food, and that became a very nice product. I'm glad he did that. But I think what melted that... I've had chocolate bars in my pocket melt, depending on what brand of chocolate and how it's made. And maybe they intentionally disturb the chemistry, the recipe of modern-day chocolate bars so that they don't melt so well when they put them in a pocket, because somebody's going to put it into a pocket periodically, and if that particular brand melts very easily, you're going to stop buying that brand. So there's more variables involved here. I think we should go over to the space report.
Before you do?
Go ahead, Glenn.
I think we have to be careful here, because next thing you know, we'll be talking about Ben Franklin and his kite story with the electricity, trying to fly a kite in the middle of a rainstorm. So we might have to rewrite some history here, Dick. KQRW, KC2, QIQ.
KQ, VCT with a question on the chocolate.
Yeah, VCC, we'll get to you in a second. Yeah, that kite story is a very dangerous thing to do. If I put wire to a kite during a rainstorm, and I'm the guy controlling that kite, in my opinion, you're amazingly close to becoming electrocuted. You never want to do that. So that so-called Ben Franklin story with a kite If he used wire to the kite, boy, he's asking for it. If he used string to the kite, and the string is sufficiently wet and conductive, there's still a lot of danger involved. So I, for one, flew a control line model airplane, a Class C control line aerobatic airplane.
I was talking to Zerupa. Did you ever fly a kite in the rain?
I never have, and I'm going to go over to you in a second, Glenn, to find out if you have. But I was flying this control line model airplane, practicing for a contest when I was 17 years of age. And it started to become a cloudy day, about to become a rainy day. And one of the maneuvers I was practicing is called a wing over, where you fly the plane parallel to the ground, do a 90-degree rise, you know, vertical, fly across the top of the circle, back down the other side. The second wing over I did, the static charge being picked up by those 60 feet of wire started jumping across the plastic handle of my Ureli and jumping into my hand. Three or four of those sparks happened. It started getting stronger and stronger. I had no choice but to let go, and the airplane crashed. I came close to electrocuting myself at the beginning of a thunderstorm in Farmingdale, in a field near what was then called Liberty Aircraft, in their ball field, while I was practicing when I was 16 years of age. First of all, let me go over to the first person, Mr. VCC, Victor Charlie Charlie, is what it sounds like. Please give me your full call letters and your question or comment and your name. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick. Go right ahead.
Yes, my name is Kathleen, and I am KC2, Victor Charlie Tango. A couple questions on the chocolate thing. I'm in the food industry, so chocolate will melt at basically a body temperature. When you microwave chocolate, the shape will remain the same, although it's softened. And when you're cooking in a microwave, when you're cooking more than one item, because the way the food cooks inside from the inside out, if you put in two baked potatoes, it can take just as long to bake it in the microwave oven as it would to take in a regular oven. So I'm wondering, with that experiment with the water and the chocolate, there's too much microwave being absorbed that the chocolate doesn't really get a chance to melt properly.
Good exception there, Kathleen. I personally have been involved in a large number of experiments over the last 2 or 3 years with various kinds of elastomers, as they're called, rubber-like substances, because we were putting rubber-like substances on antenna elements in order to make them flexible, protected, and whatever, and we found a huge amount of difference in the what's called loss tangent, in other words, the amount of RF energy that's absorbed by various kinds of rubber. On all of those experiments, we were putting the piece of rubber, let me pick a number, 4 inches to the left of a glass of water. In every one of those experiments, we had a glass of water in the microwave oven with the unknown substance. And I'm trying to think of the name of the substance now. It was a kind of a plastic-like substance that became an almost perfect dummy load. With 1 minute of microwave oven, it got so hot to the touch, the piece of plastic, you couldn't hold it in your hand. Another kind of yucky-looking rubber in the exact same experiment ran absolutely ice cold. So the standard load, let me drop. I'm still left to believe that the standard load of the glass of water in the microwave oven during the experiment is required, because if I had a material that was just a little bit lossy in the microwave oven without the glass of water, instead of the microwaves bouncing 3 times and being absorbed by a very lossy element, they bounce 15 times and still be absorbed by the lossy element. I would get the exact same result, so to speak, if there was no standard load for the microwave oven. It becomes very difficult to judge. With the standard load of a glass of water, I can easily differentiate between a good dielectric material and a bad dielectric material. And I personally made a whole lot of measurements of materials. And then when we went and confirmed by putting those materials on the antenna, the good material and the bad material, we saw a huge difference in the apparent gain of this 900 meg antenna. So it is, in my opinion, a good way of doing the test. How you quantify the results, I'll admit, are a little bit difficult. But when you're measuring your Tupperware, just putting the Tupperware in the oven all by itself without a glass of water, you can easily be fooled into thinking that the Tupperware is bad and it might be good, if you know what I mean. That's my recommendation on that. Glenn wanted to make a comment on this. KC2QI2, KQIs will be waiting for the beep, Scott. Glenn. I thought it was Glenn. Maybe I'm wrong. Who was the person who wanted to make a comment? KQLIW? Okay, we're going to come back to the subject. I guarantee we haven't finished this one. I'm going to be finishing the salt water experiment with a better instrumentation without making a galvanic battery. And I've already done a whole lot of experiments with various kinds of chocolate in the microwave oven. And I'm reasonably convinced that the Percy Spencer story is not accurate. Because if I could double the temperature in degrees Fahrenheit of the chest of a human being because I'm heating it with a microwave oven, yes, I'd sort of believe what Glenn was saying. But the way the thermal regulation works on a normal human being, I don't think I can get the... I don't think the skin on your chest under normal circumstances with normal clothing is ever going to go below, let me pick a number, 94 or 95 degrees Fahrenheit. And if I'm artificially heating the skin with microwave energy, I don't think you're going to tolerate an amount of heating beyond, let me pick a number, 104 degrees Fahrenheit, 105. By then, you're going to be feeling for darn much heat of those microwaves. You're going to say, I don't want to stay here, and I'm afraid of damaging my eyes. So when it comes to the rate of melting a chocolate bar with skin at 95 degrees versus 105 degrees, the difference is so darn small that I can't believe that in one case the bar is going to, you know, really melt, in the other case the bar is going to stay pristine. So even the heating of a human being by the microwaves